Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. And this week we're actually joined by two
someones.
So it's someone's plural. You know, and we're joined by Grant Owens and Connor Brady of Critical Mass. What's up, guys?
Hey, thanks for having us.
How's it going?
Awesome. Great, guys.
Yeah, we've talked about phones, technology, battery life. We've covered a lot of stuff.
You're doing
off
a tremendous
mic
job.
When we're doing Fantastic. A tremendous
many people,
job.
Many people have told us that.
Everyone's talking about it.
Everyone. And I think it's true. And I think the other agencies are sad.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about Critical Mass before we get into the meat of why you're here? Like, tell us your expertise, the founding.
Yeah,
just
sure.
Pick one.
So,
go for it.
Critical Mass is a digital agency. We just celebrated 20 years last year. Yeah. Originated from Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Okay.
And started a sort of a small shop there back in the, as we were just discussing off mic, sort of the heyday of .com as it came up in the late 90s. But has been around ever since, and since become, what are we now, 11 offices mm-hmm. worldwide?
As you can tell by our really strong Canadian accents that we're not actually from Canada.
Yeah.
So we're a global agency now. So we've spread out across US and into Europe and into Asia as well. So it's got a decent footprint.
Yeah, and we do a lot of things that you would expect digital marketing agencies to do, but our real core focus is experience design. So we're out there trying to create customer experiences for major brands.
How would you define experience design?
Connor's responsible for it, so I'll let him describe it.
You know, I think one of the things that we realized a few years back is technology became a big influencer on design in mm-hmm. general and how we interact with things. And I think up until that point, we were spending a lot of time just designing for screens and really thinking about just the interaction that's sort of set in front of you. But I think that opened up with technology where you got into the physical space, the phone came along, iPhone came along, iBeacons came along, and we were considering so much more than just that thing that's set in front of your face.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that opened up this whole idea of a complete experience. So it's like, what's it feel like when you walk into a building and you've got a phone in your pocket and the building changes or the environment changes? So it became more about a complete experience as opposed to a unique singular experience. We were starting to piece things together to create like a brand.
Yeah.
That sort of lived in a digital environment as opposed to thinking about it living on a screen.
Right.
And I think that was the difference. And as we've started to do that now, the thing that we're finding is this new technology comes along that redefines itself literally every single month, which is kind of interesting for us. It kind of keeps you on your toes.
And it feels like in experience design, there's always something to fix. Like we all go through it every day. You run into something, a brand interaction or an interaction that you do, and it just doesn't feel right. And you know the interaction could be better. That's what we see as our job. Like if we can fix those things for real life people, then we're doing a good job.
I mean, we work a lot in automotive. I mean, automotive's classic. Like think about technology in the car now. It's completely different with heads-up display and sensors around the car and how your phone connects to the car, how you pre-interact with your car before you get into it. I mean, that to us is experience design. It's not just designing the little interaction that sits on the navigation screen in the car. It's like the whole thing that sits around.
And that has so many implications. I was listening to a conversation once on the difference between like, I mean, there's a lot of reasons behind this, but if you listen to like New York beats and hip hop versus LA beats, I forget where this conversation was, but it was a great basic distinction. Someone was like, well, New York, you walk and you're on the subway.
That was me.
Oh, that was you. Yeah. There you go. Classic. And then L.A. I don't know where
LA,
I heard this.
You drive.
And then L.A. you drive. Yeah. So it's a completely different soundscape. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was actually a point made here by Phil.
Yeah. Yeah.
Deep hip-hop historian.
Yeah.
Much of a driver.
And not much of a driver.
We talk about that a lot. And in a lot of our conversations is context. And so what you're doing with a device in one context – be it in the home, is very different than what you're doing when you're out on the street. We were going to talk about voice interaction today, for the point being that it's such a challenge to think about how you do that at the moments that you need some discretion and privacy. When you're on the street, you don't want to ask certain things, but when you're in the home, the context totally changes. So the experience that you design for that could be quite different.
Right.
I mean, I think that's a great segue. Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
To lead us into
good experience design, guys.
How you designed that.
Even the show inside of our bubble.
Amazing. Yeah.
Don't try to manipulate my context. Excuse you.
But we want to talk about voice and AI and the focal point of this new white paper that was recently published. I think, how long has it been?
Just a few weeks.
Yeah. So voice and AI interactions in particular. So sort of let's start with what was the incentive to publishing the paper and working on this topic in particular?
It was probably a meeting that Connor and I were sitting in maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, and recognized, I think I had just purchased my third Amazon Echo, and realized that it had taken over our household. Connor was diving into it as well. My daughters are 4 and 2, and they'll never have known a world without Alexa. And everything that they do in the home, they start talking to the machine right away. And I think I can't remember what client we were sitting with, and we just realized that it's going to happen, and it's going to happen pretty quickly. And when we think about voice interaction and voice design for voice interaction, it's a totally different way of thinking. There's a lot that we as an industry have created around like menus and linear thinking as you march down a navigation, that if you get into natural language interaction, doesn't need to exist. Like the last 20 years have basically been like a false creation to navigate information. So what do you need a left nav for when I can just ask you, hey, what are the price of those shoes?
Right.
As you know, thinking about
know,
that.
I would look it up.
Exactly. Yeah. And thinking about that, well, maybe I won't ask you then. We'll go back to Siri, she knows. But thinking about that menu-based interaction is really like a false creation that we can move away from.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. I mean, I've sort of invested a lot of time in dying formats as a designer. I used to be a record cover designer, actual records.
Yeah. You
know, and then that sort of died. And then I sort of got into digital and started to design websites. And I feel when we sat in this meeting, the thing that we realized was that there was going to be a massive paradigm shift in how we interact with things in general. And we have spent decades building best practices around how you design a website, navigation and SEO and all of the things that we do in our industry. And I think voice will be a thing that could come along and completely flip that on its head. I mean, it takes visual design off the screen almost completely. And it makes the brand that you're talking to rely almost completely on audio, on sound, which is, if you think about it, when we do brand design, we don't think of it in the audio context. Like, what does this brand sound like? And that's going to be critical for these brands going forward, as I use either Google or Apple now have their version of it through Siri, or Alexa, whenever I talk to a brand, what's it going to say back? It's not the interaction design anymore. It's not the visual design. It's what it's going to like sound like, I think, is going to be critical for us. So it means a whole new skill set for us, a whole new way of thinking about a brand, a whole new way of designing. I mean, really, you're designing soundscapes now as opposed to like menus and pages and sort of, you know, chapters, really.
People feel more unsettled? But like, there's a kind of broader question in general that all of these companies have so much of our information and the sort of privacy being a thing of the past, and there's a need on a regulatory level to address that and a need on a corporate level to address that as separate issues. But then there's like the innate feel. It's interesting when you talk about particularly something like Alexa. Mm-hmm. I guess Siri doesn't produce as much anxiety because you enlist Siri, sort of. She might not pop out of nowhere, I guess, unless you like, you know, hit your home
does it
tab.
On your phone?
Yeah, she does now.
I guess it does at times.
Yeah.
You're right. And so when you get
house.
When you get a written pop-up, that doesn't feel, and this is all irrational, it's but
intrusive.
It doesn't feel as intrusive.
Yeah.
When you hear an alien voice on a machine, that cues the big brother sort of anxiety.
Completely.
So are we trying to do like, so is the answer, and I think the answer of making it like super friendly and accommodating is actually even more creepy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So is the approach to actually kind of be clear about, you know, as you're designing the auditory culture, like this is essentially a robot, it's an information data thing, and we're not going to try to make it your friend or personalize it? Or do we start doing like GPS systems and all of a sudden you can, you know, do you want a British butler or Snoop Dogg giving you your directions, right?
Which is an option.
Yeah. Oh, no, those are all options. I have used all of them.
And Darth Vader's an option. The Darth
really?
Vader voice. Yeah, I've heard that one.
Well, it's an interesting observation because when you think about a website, it only does something whenever you on action.
Right.
So this thing sits in the corner and the theory or the paranoia is that it's constantly listening. And I think the push isn't to make it seem more robotic. Now the push is to make it feel more human. So you look at what people are doing with voice, and how they're, I mean, there's a, NPR did a fantastic piece on the guys in Boston that replicated Obama's voice to the, I mean, it sounded like Obama, but it wasn't. It was someone typing it in and hitting play. So they've got it to the point now where you cannot tell the difference. So you get to that point.
Fuck white people.
It's like, come on. It's like, that's, I mean, it's kind of insane. I think it's actually going to go the other way from that.
And yeah, yeah, even that's more what I'm wondering. That might, yeah. People might want to actually say, like, wait a
put
second.
The brakes
let's
on.
Be clear about what this is and stop trying to humanize that experience.
Yeah. I think there's like two points that, like, as I went through the report and just kind of think about, like, my personal experiences with stuff, I'm sort of, I guess, the studio Luddite. Like, I think I'm the slowest adapter to technology, probably. Everything scares me.
I mean, objectively, yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
everything scares
just
me.
Just for today, let's make make you the Luddite.
Yeah, I'm definitely the guy.
In fact, yeah.
And I'm wondering about the predictive nature of these technologies. Yeah. So you mentioned that a website activates when you need it. And it seems like voice... would be something that, to a certain extent, is there a need for it to be predictive? Is that where we're heading? And then I'm also curious about that being more human, the empathy part of this.
Yeah.
You know, like, how does that factor? So I guess those are two questions that are somewhat coupled in at least my mind.
Yeah, one way to think about that, I think there will be generational different expectations. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you listen to a Gen Xer talk to an Alexa, they actually talk in keywords because they've been trained to think that the world works in keywords.
Snips.
But if you listen to my 4-year-old daughter talk to Alexa, she just talks to Alexa.
Right.
So there's a different expectation, I think, and I will obviously gravitate toward that more natural language one. But to answer your specific question about AI and the predictive intelligence of things, if you want a true agent like we thought about in the sci-fi movies from the 60s, a true agent would do that. And to your point, Michael, I think there are times when you know, people will have an adverse reaction to that. It feels a little too human. So we got to go through that weird phase, and it's cliche to call it, but it's definitely the uncanny valley like you see in cinema with CGI, where we're going to get close here. And it's going to be weird for a few minutes, and then it's going to get so good it's no longer weird. And I think we'll hit that pretty soon. In some ways, we already are hitting that when I say a word or a commercial kicks on Alexa, sort of without me meaning to kick it on. I'm like, oh man, a reminder that it's always listening. The truth is, on the privacy front, it actually isn't saving anything. Mm-hmm. So we had our team dive into it. It's only on the hard drive saving 6 seconds. Of information on the actual device, but until you say Alexa, nothing goes up to the cloud. And so when they've done these cases where they've tried to get information on crimes and such, not a lot the device is listening to unless the victim says, hey Alexa, start listening.
It opens up. Session.
So there are already some of those safeguards putting into place.
When you talk about, and then the other kind of very interesting aspect of this sort of human dimension starts to kick in, and you guys address this in the report too, when we start to make, because I think, you know, making the shift from just it's another sort of way of managing information or acquiring information, but we're now going to kick into it reminds people to take their medications as an example, or potential future uses for like elder care as an example.
Yeah.
It's almost, I mean, it is actually really driving much more deeply into the concern I had raised earlier, which is that this is part of like a technology that could almost be integrated with medical systems, with even ideas of pets and sociability and kind of connectivity. Is that kind of, you know, is that something, first of all, that for people maybe that are already in, you know, elder care now as an example, will they not be able to bridge it because of the sort of innate comfort levels and issues that we're talking about? And headed forward, I mean, does even the kind of concern that I raised earlier as these technologies change, does that become just a completely passe question in a matter of years as this stuff just becomes matter of fact? Like, is it that type of technology? Is it because I feel like technology now is either incredibly overhyped and actually has very little effect on our lives, or it is so, it's almost underhyped because it becomes completely ubiquitous and seamless. It's like it's either one of those two things. There's nothing in the middle. It's either like, oh, that literally has changed the way we do everything, or that's, you know, nonsense. It doesn't matter.
I have a neighbor here in just four blocks away. He's probably in his 70s, doesn't own an iPhone, and doesn't own a computer. As soon as he sat down in front of Google Home, and I said, ask a question, say this, okay, Google, and ask a question, and he did. He was amazed. And there was something there. He saw the screen as a barrier to technology. He saw that as a barrier for him to get any bad eyesight. He doesn't really know how to type. It stopped him wanting to engage with the technology. This was so easy for him. All of the paranoia and stuff that we have around it, he doesn't have that. He's just like, oh, I can ask it anything. And you can, to your point, you can ask it to set an alarm and remind you to take your medication. And he was just like, oh, how do I do that? Just tell it. And he would just speak to it and it would work, right? So it sort of removed all of the learning curve that you have to have with sites and keyboards and things that you have to do on a desktop or somewhere else. And it just made it super simple for him. So I saw that as kind of an interesting introduction to technology for that demographic that so often gets overlooked when it comes
to
technology.
Does that start to help us cut down all the time we waste on technology and managing information systems? We can get back to the kind of original sort of dream of the internet.
Totally. Just tell it to do things.
We're working on an example, a prototype we're doing right now with a hotel brand, and they're looking at how do we put voice devices in the room. And we came back, and the whole insight we had was really quite silly. I don't like to touch hotel remotes, and Connor's not a huge fan either. And we're like, well, why don't we just do that through voice? Because they're gross, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Turns out the data proves that out. They are very gross.
I don't need data to tell me that.
We just know that.
There's a lot of things in hotels that are actually pretty gross if you think about it.
But they came back.
Something called common sense, which we shouldn't allow to completely escape.
They're smarter than we are, and they came back and said, the real use case here is accessibility. And people who don't have the capabilities that most of us have to interact with their room, to order room service, to turn on the TV, to call the concierge.
Something go wrong in the room and they're in the bathroom and something happens and they're like, I need help. They can just say
it.
Help.
Right.
And it will pick it up and it will send someone to the room. I think that's kind of an interesting scenario. It is interesting to think about all the promise that the internet had. I mean, how many times do you sit down in front of a screen with a single task in mind, but then you sidetrack for 20 minutes? That's not going to happen in one of these devices because you'll ask it the task and then you'll move along.
Mm.
So it keeps you, I think it keeps you focused. And you go to it with a purpose, you ask it a question, you get an answer, and you move on, as opposed to what I do all of the time is a 30-minute diatribe, sidetrack.
New challenge for advertisers to do that.
Yes. Yeah. Let's hope.
Yeah, right.
Let's hope. Absolutely. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
And the idea of language, not even strictly in the way we've been talking about it now, but having these devices recognize different dictions, slang, accents.
Yep.
My parents are not from here. They have an accent. So my friends tell me they have an accent.
I'm sorry, Phil. Can you repeat that?
Is that how much do we default, or how much has this technology that you guys have found defaulted to the King's English as compared to tying into sort of other ways in which people routinely communicate with one another? Has that been talked about at all? Or
absolutely, we in a big way,
a big failure in the middle of a meeting.
What was the word you were trying to say?
Laser. I would not read it. It was like, sorry, can you repeat that? Instead of 10 times, I just said lights.
Yeah, for the listeners, what Connor said was laser. But it absolutely is, and the more important aspect of that is when you look at AI or intelligence, what you risk is that you put a bias into it based on who programs it, and so you found that in facial recognition technology, where people of color can't be recognized by facial recognition because the software wasn't created by someone who understands it.
And we're ninjas.
It's like racist
and we're
AI.
And we're
sorry, I don't see color.
Yeah.
What was that?
Totally. But the same.
Why do you always make it a racial issue? I don't know who you are.
If you think about it this way, if Alexa's sitting in the majority of affluent homes right now, but the Alexa engine is learning only that, that machine is getting smarter based on a homogenous group of people. Right. And so if you look 3 or 4 years out, how are you ensuring that there's diversity thrown into the algorithm?
That's right.
And whether it's accent or dialect or region of the country or phrases, the Queen's English versus U.S. English.
Yeah, I speak a version of the Queen's English, and Siri does not understand a word I say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not there yet. It's still struggling with it. It understands American English really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you go beyond that and you say the slightest things, you have to say it 2-3 times before it will get it.
Do you think that raises bigger challenges? I mean, we do work on this show and then in our consulting work on sort of like cultural amplification versus gentrification and a lot of issues on like cultural strategy and brands not being destructive morons about culture. Mm-hmm. And when you go into the tech space, like Grant McCracken, who we admire a lot and has kind of mentored us in some ways, told a story once about talking to somebody in tech. And he said, what is the culture of your app? Like, who's using it? What's happening on the other side? And the guy looked at him and he said, the end user. In the sense that it was completely like there was not even the beginnings of a sketch of the conversation we're having.
Yeah.
And so that's a very dangerous thing if the future of innovation technology in a massive part of the economy, which will change how we live entirely. I mean, I know you guys are injecting it into the conversation. Yeah. This paper addresses it, but I mean, it still seems like it's really not there in any type of significant way. Like, it needs a massive influx of anthropologists and other people who think in those terms.
It's got to be a deliberate effort. Yeah. You know, there's sort of a couple ways this could go. And if you saw the article just yesterday about them shutting down a particular piece of AI because it had created its own language.
Yeah.
That is one way it could go, right? The machine could become so smart that it's the one injecting diversity because it knows it needs to get smarter. But right now we're at a programming point where people need to inject that. Right.
You
influence.
Joked about it earlier, data or data, I guess, depending on where you're from, how you say it. It gets thrown out all the time. The data proves it. It proves what? Like, where's the humanity in that? It's like spreadsheets of numbers. So how does that bring in a little bit what you're talking about, like ethnography? I mean, how does that work?
And the shift in language, you know, as, you know, we mentioned like hip-hop earlier, but, you know, other types of music as well, like, language is something that shifts. Words that meant one thing in one context now mean
a whole other meaning.
Something totally different.
That's right,
You know, and so those are always like the things I kind of think about, like how do these machines or applications like
stay cultural?
Yeah, how do they stay culturally relevant when that stuff happens so quickly?
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of what we're doing now, and I think we're probably in a 2-3 year period where we're going to continue, is we're sort of putting it in the can. We're loading it with what it needs to know to react with us. And you know, because Connor and I come from that generation that was built around menus and filtering, I think we've even struggled to change our mindset when we design these things to not think about building it that way, to try and become more natural language and interaction. Mm-hmm. So right now we're in that middle stage, but I think when we get to true artificial intelligence, natural language interaction, that won't be as much of a factor.
But we see it even on our own design teams. When we have our own meetings, like the age range in our design teams can be 20 years. And they'll say things in meetings where I'll be, sorry, what? What's that even mean? You know, and because they're like a whole other. What was the slide right into my DMs?
Yeah. Oh, you guys should explore that. It's fun. Oh, wait. I apologize if your wives are listening.
To your point, things having different meanings. DM to me, growing up in London 15, 20 years ago, was Dr. Martin's. DMs. Oh, yeah. DMs to them were direct messages. So my head went straight to...
So you were talking about sliding into ugly shoes?
No,
they were
pretty cool.
I'm just kidding.
Connor just responded no.
Doc words are super popular.
It was like one of those
20 years ago, right?
It was kind of like...
Still now.
Connor spends a lot of time on Urban Dictionary trying to catch up.
Quietly, Doc Martens, here's a little cultural thing.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of folks, like I'm in a fraternity. And when you do like step shows and stepping is a big part of like the African American fraternity experience. Yep. You wear boots.
Right.
And you're going to wear either like Doc Martens or like
Timberlands.
Combat boots or fewer Timberlands because they're rubberized soles.
They don't make
a good sound. You need to hit.
You need a good sound.
Yeah. So Doc Martens are popular in many different areas.
Do you call them DMs or like Connor does? Or you?
No, we call them Doc Martens. Yeah. Yeah. But Mary J. Blige, when she first came out,
she had Doc Martens back then?
Doc Martens. Wow. She had that whole.
Well, she had. All right. Well, that revises my opinion. Nothing either of you said.
The whole.
but I like Mary J. Blige.
The whole Scott culture in England was all Dr. Martens, yeah. DMs. That was the whole thing. Right. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Sorry, we digress.
Yeah.
But this is perfect. This is the point.
But this is
hidden meaning. I had no idea what they were talking about, right?
And even that context of like, sliding into like that's
no idea what they were talking about.
Contextual way of saying something that isn't the typical word doesn't really mean that.
How could if you haven't programmed that sort of lexicon into the machine, how could it understand it?
Would you understand digitally hollering?
Do we?
I'm still trying to translate this.
It sounds like typing in all caps to me.
Or at least 3 exclamation marks.
Right? Yeah, I mean, you know, functionally, it basically is. Yeah. All right. You guys got the real meaning of it.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
This is a fascinating topic. The one thing I want to do another music question real quick. Do we have time?
Yeah.
Okay. Because this came up in another conversation around rock music kind of being dead. And we did this
about a week or two ago,
where like that, for the first time, like hip hop and R&B like passed rock as like the
selling
relevant, whatever music. And then we had a conversation about that. But separate from that, there's all this idea of where is like music and programmable music going? Mm. And a friend offered that with all of these sort of technologies, if you think about making beats, people now used, you know, Garage and all these different things to make beats and make music. They didn't have to pick up an instrument to learn how to do it.
Do it with a keyboard.
And then you could do like a literal computer keyboard or pads or what have you. Mm-hmm. And now with voice activation, do you guys see a place for that playing a role in the creation of music? Because this was offered by a friend who is a musician who said, like, you could be making a piece of music and say, like, Alexa, drop in drums here, or let me hear how this sounds. Like, it's more of a process where it's participatory.
Interesting.
You know, and he's talking from a musician's perspective. So that really made me curious about its implications in these sorts of technologies. Like, is that true? Do you guys see that sort of functionality coming?
The example that you give earlier is just the speed of doing things amplifies a lot. So instead of having to click through a series of menus to get to a task, you just say it and it happens in a much more abbreviated time frame. I think of the process of making music when you're trying to lay down tracks and figure out, does this work over this or does this work over this? Like sitting, mixing that, playing it back, mixing it, playing it back is a pretty long process. I think voice interaction there, especially if you pulled in some sort of artificial intelligence into the back of that work, could make some shortcuts for you. Like the things that don't work, it's out of tune or whatever. I could see it really working there as far as like the creative process being sped up. I don't think it's going to replace the need for someone to be able to think what about good music sounds like. I think it's just going to enable them to get to it quicker. Probably. I don't know. I never thought about it in the context of music. I'm just thinking about sitting in front of a desk because I worked in music industry for a long time and watching how long it would take for someone to get a 30-second piece of music exactly the way they wanted it. And wondering if voice or just artificial intelligence together at the back of that speeds that up and does something or suggests things back to you, which is like, well, don't put it in C major, try this and see whatever. Yeah. Maybe it can sort of start to get you there quicker. I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's, I agree with that. I think it's probably less about the voice interaction, more about the AI that's applied to it. There's been a couple of case studies where I think it was IBM had done a thing with Watson where they had applied Watson to like, what's the right audio hook that people like? And then they created a song based on what Watson thought people would like. And if you listen to the song, you're like, even if you don't like it, you recognize that it does represent popular music right now and what people do tend to listen to. So I think that's interesting where AI sort of comes in and is like, well, it's like a virtual producer for you, kind of picks a hook that works. I heard a scientist talk about jazz music one time and brilliant understanding of how the human brain works, where jazz is so good because what jazz does is takes you off into like crazy land, but then brings you back to a routine or rhythm. And when it does that, your brain actually gets a hit of dopamine, because what humans love is consistency and clarity and routine. Mm. But then every once in a while, they like to escape. but then they want to be brought back to a safe zone. Yeah. So when the drummer goes off and the trumpeter goes off, but then they all come back to that riff that you remember, your brain gets a shot of dopamine. And I think it's a fascinating way to think about how AI could be applied to
doing that.
To that, yeah, yeah, because it could solve a lot of that. Maybe not creatively, but at least apply some knowledge to it.
Like, Alexa, I need some dopamine.
Right now. Yeah. Play something that's going to do that.
Give me some dopamine.
Well,
now,
you guys have made this Luddite feel a lot more comfortable. Maybe it's because I've also been watched her like twice in the past 2 weeks.
That made you feel comfortable?
No, not the movie, the
That's interesting. I watched her, and I thought the whole thing should be shut down.
So that raised, that raised a lot of, like, between that and Black Mirror.
I thought, like, a lot of men should be, like,
yeah, that series was pretty incredible.
Those two frightened me.
A pretty bleak picture of the future of technology.
Exactly.
I loved it.
Exactly. Yeah. But no, guys, this has been great. Yeah, thanks so much for coming in the studio with us.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks.